knows not. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what we should do in the face of obscure matters. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Amir al-Mu'mineen's early life in Medina was not that easy financially. And so during the early days, Amir al-Mu'mineen was not, we would not use the term affluent as in that way. But during the time of the three Khulafa, 23 to 24 years, Amir al-Mu'mineen was busy. Not on the political issues. He was busy in what is known as reviving the barren lands between Medina and Rabigh towards Mecca. And I talked about it, you know, in detail in one of the Ramadan majalis a few years ago. And I think maybe there is a time sometimes to repeat that because I don't think everybody would remember the details of it. But it's worth studying that part of Ali's life. In Islamic laws, there is a concept that if there is a land which is not owned by individuals, so it's not a private property, and it is a barren land where you cannot do any cultivation, if you are able to revive that, it's called Ihya al-Mawat, reviving the dead land or the barren land, that actually becomes your property as long as you work on it and the produce comes out. And Amir al-Mu'mineen used to go to those areas where it was desert area, mostly, you know, there was no source of water. And he, with his own hand, will start digging wells. And he will, you know, basically go very deep down until the water comes out. And once the source of water was there, then he would start planting palm trees, the seeds for that. And in a few years, you know, the trees came up and started giving dates, khurma. And this is not just one, two, three in the backyard or the front yard of our home. We are talking about, you know, huge parcels of lands. There is an area when you go from Medina towards Mecca for, you know, your Umrah or Hajj, you pass by an area known as Rabigh. This was an area where Amir al-Mu'mineen dug 5 water wells. It means at 5, you know, good distances. It must be a large area. And he planted, you know, palm trees there and asked one of his slaves that I make you in charge to take care of it. You stay here with your family, work for 5 years, and then you are free. And you can use the produce for yourself. But then he says, there was a portion of it, a large portion, he says, this is for sadaqah and charity. And this is not only there, even outside, you know, the city of Medina itself, even now if you Google, go to the Google Maps on Medina, you will see one of the suburbs of Medina. It says Abiyar Ali. Abiyar is plural of Be'er. Be'er means water well. Abiyar Ali means the water wells of Ali. It means even near Medina, Rasulullah, the Amir al-Mu'minin would go and dig the water wells. And still that name, that area is now known as Abiyar Ali. In Arabic, I was told by one of the ulama, he said, when you go there and stop, if your car or bus, you know, stops there, go and ask for, buy water water bottle. He says, look at the label there. It says Be'er Ali. Means the water well of Ali. Means those water wells dug by Ali 1400 years ago are still the source of water in that area. And he said, I have made these water wells as waqf, an endowment for the travelers and the Hujjaj caravan who pass by this area. And there were many other plantations where he would dedicate a portion for charity and the rest to maintain his own family. This was the source of the revenue of Ali and his children. And it continued till the days of the sixth Imam. Maybe even later on, because in studying their history, the further I could go was, you know, there was a dispute between the descendants of Hassan and Hussein. Who will be the trustee or the custodian of that endowment of Ali? It means those areas were still in the hands of the children of Ali. And it was producing revenue. And so by the time the Muslims, 24 years or 25 years after Ghadir, exactly by the day on the 18th of Zulhijjah, 25 years after Ghadir, when the Muslims came to the door of Ali. And they said, Ali, we don't want anyone now but you. And at that time when Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, accepted to become their Khalifa and their leader, the very first speech he gave, and I want to relate this with the source of revenue that he had. He says to them, إِنِّي حَامِلُكُمْ عَلَى مِنْحَاجِ نَبِيِّكُمْ, that I'm going to take you back on the path of your prophet or the sunnah of the prophet. MashaAllah, people are known as Ahlul Sunnah. But Ali realizes in that 24 years, they had deviated from the minhaj and the sunnah of the prophet. He says, Inni hamilukum, I will carry you onto the minhaj of Rasulullah. And what was his minhaj? One of the main things he says that Rasulullah, whenever he distributed the Baytul Mal, the public treasury among Muslims, he distributed that equally. Arab, non-Arabs, Qurayshi, Ghairi Qurayshi, Muhajir, Ansar, doesn't matter. Everyone would be treated equally here. Master or slave. All the problems Amir al-Mu'mineen faced after that was because of that. Because all those who were used to the privileges in the last three administrations, they didn't like that. But then he makes a comment here. He says, remember, I will follow the same tradition of Rasulullah in distributing the Baytul Mal as long as I have a cluster of dates from my palm trees. I will not take my own share from Baytul Mal. So remember, a person who is depriving himself of his own share, don't expect from him to give you more than your share. But these words, as long as I have a cluster of dates coming from my palm trees, you wouldn't understand this khutbah until you look what he was doing in the last 20 to 23 years. You know, reviving the barren lands, and this became a source of income for him. So by the time Amir al-Mu'mineen now becomes Khalifatul Muslimin, ruler of the Muslim Empire, now he is an affluent and rich person. But this is where we say he is Imam al-Muttaqeen. A person who has a huge source of income, now that he is becoming the ruler of the Muslims, he decides to live a simple life. You know, many times we talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen, he was a very simple man, lived a simple life. It's not because of poverty. It was by choice. He had. Actually, the children were still living comfortably. But he himself, as the ruler of the Muslims, decided that no, I will live a simple life so that the most poor person in the Muslim Ummah and the Muslim Empire would be able to relate to me.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the history of Qasr edifice, the story of a museum that has had so many ups and downs, dependent to the different utilization of the place. The journey from a luxurious palace, which was converted to a dreadful political prison and is now a museum. The story of the Qasr edifice is intertwined with some of the most turbulent and crucial years of Iran's history. And within the confines of its walls, it holds countless memories of suffering and struggle. Don't go away. Here's the rest of the documentary.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
During the time the prisoner was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's why some families knew their children were there.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savvak brutality. In hindsight, Savvak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davud Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Gas prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
Savak's harassment and torture accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger and continued the struggle to overthrow the decadent regime.
In 1974, student activities intensified and street demonstrations flared up. With draconian power, Savak set a reign of terror that lasted 2 years. Many were arrested, tortured, or even killed on the slightest charges. This era was one of the darkest chapters in the history of modern Iran.
در سال 55 رژیم شاه تصمیم داشت.
In 1976, the regime had decided to put in prison whoever showed the least opposition, thinking that in this way it could reduce the numbers of its opponents. Therefore, the prisons of the Shah became overcrowded, that is, political prisons. At that time, the Kasra prison and others were overcrowded.
Inside prisons, clerics would shoulder a special burden to teach young prisoners and broaden their horizons.
Prominent religious scholars like Ayatollah Taleghani and others tried to attract other people rather than to reject them. Even a person who had caved in a little to Savak torture would get ablaze when associated with such great people.
Savak, long suspicious of clerics' activities in prisons and afraid of their success, began to hold them back.
قبل از سال 53 شرایط بسیار مطلوب بود برای زندانی.
Up to the year 1974, the circumstances were desirable for political prisoners because there was no separation between them. For example, Mr. Taleghani and other prominent figures were all in the same prison, with a young man sentenced to a few months for distributing communiques. Such a man would mix with them and get trained by them. The political prison had become the University of the Revolution. But after the year 1974, most of the religious scholars were transferred to Evin Penitentiary, to a place specifically for religious scholars in order to disconnect their relations with other prisons so as to prevent them from growing.
Identifying different political and ideological currents in prisons and sowing discord among prisoners were on the list of Savak's priorities. The main aim was to pit opposition leaders against one another, tarnish their reputations and drain them of power so they couldn't fight the regime.
Savak itself would provoke prisoners to discuss with each other and pit them against each other. So it was probable that a problem would rise between those people, and the winner was Savak. So to avoid such a thing inside prison, the prisoners tried to keep their unity, saying, "We have a common enemy, and in front of this common enemy, we have to be united and must not provide Savak with excuses."
By arresting political dissidents, Savak aimed to quench the raging flames of the revolution. But since almost all political prisoners were transferred to Tehran, the prisons became a hive of political activity. The prisoners were filled in on the latest gossip, news, or instructions and announcements issued by Ayatollah Khomeini by their families, who would visit them from every corner of the nation.
The best point of this prison had to do with meetings. A long, narrow corridor, a wall about 1 meter in height with rails and nettings, and a distance of 1 meter with officers in between.
When they came here, they would stand behind bars, prisoners on this side. Imagine such a large number of visitors who wanted to talk to prisoners all at the same time in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes, all of them wanted to talk and tell their things. How was it possible for them to do so in 10 minutes? That's while some prisoners and families had to exchange political information from inside and outside the prison.
Mr. Mansouri believes political prisoners have always been well informed about the country's affairs.
After all, political prisoners would try regularly to be up to date and have the best analysis of the issues. It may be interesting to know that we in prison knew much more about the country's issues than those who were outside prison. The reason was that, besides studying and discussing, those families who came to see their children would give them information from all over the country, and this information would come into prison.
Drunk with absolute power, the Shah of Iran gave Savak more leeway to oppress any opposition. No matter how hard political parties struggled, the prospect looked grim. From 1975, Savak stopped releasing political prisoners, even after serving their sentences.
At that time, freedom had no meaning for the political prisoner, even for a person who had finished his term in prison. There are many examples of this case who had finished their terms in prison in 1977, but they were not released from prison.
One week before their release, they would be transferred to Evin Penitentiary, and on their release days, they were forced to sign their detention papers. After serving their time, their families were waiting for them on their release days. They would be counting the days for their release. But not only were they not released on the day, but also they were given a detention paper to sign and held in Evin Penitentiary. What's the significance of Evin? In Evin, there was no visit. The families lost touch with the prisoners again.
In those days, the Shah was the cruelest dictator in the Middle East, and reports on human rights in Iran were disappointing. But since the US didn't put pressure on its Iranian ally, the Shah never admitted the deplorable conditions in his country.
You're saying you do what every country does.
Sure.
If torture is necessary, you torture.
Not the torture in the old sense of torturing people, twisting their arms and doing this and that. But there are intelligent ways of questioning now.
Well, they talk about psychological and physical torture.
Physical, I don't believe.
I talked...
Not anymore. Maybe in the old days, maybe.
I talked just today to a man whom I believe who told about torture.
He was tortured?
Yes.
And you believe that he was tortured?
Yes.
How many years ago?
I want to be very careful. Not yesterday.
Ah, well, maybe. I don't know.
The word has gone out to stop it.
To stop what?
Torture.
But a long time ago, yes.
Until 1976, the Shah was a despot, a ruthless man with everything at his disposal. Above all, the country's wealth. That year, the Republicans in the US stepped down from power. The Shah had spent the country's petrodollars on his favorite candidate, Gerald Ford. But in the end, the young Jimmy Carter, with his slogan of human rights, was sworn in as the new president of the United States.
The human rights must be absolute. But let no one confuse our idealism with weakness. Because we are free, we can never be indifferent to the fate of freedom elsewhere.
در جریان انتخابات ریاست جمهوری امریکا
During the U.S. presidential elections, in order to earn a domestic and international reputation, the Democratic nominee announced his decision over abiding by human rights because his predecessors didn't do that at all. They were Republican, abrasive, belligerent, and suppressive. When they came to power, they asked all the dictators who were U.S. pawns to open political space and improve the image of the U.S.
The Shah of Iran made a U-turn on political freedom and an attempt to win favor with the new U.S. president. As a result, the Savak's harassment reduced and political activities increased.
It was decided that international organizations like the Red Crescent, Amnesty International, the Human Rights Organization, to visit the country's prisons, the political prisons. The Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee had a torture chamber. They quickly put some shelves in the torture chamber and converted it into a library. They put the books they had taken from us there to tell the international organizations that they had a library in the prison.
With this democratic gesture, the Shah aimed to ameliorate the situation and persuade the White House to sell him arms. Both Carter and the Shah rested assured that with the Savak and the most powerful army in the region, an open political space would never put the regime in danger.
The U.S. Senate had asked the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Cyrus Vance, "Mr. Vance, if political freedom in Iran leads to the downfall of the Shah, you will be held responsible." Vance said that they would abide by human rights as far as U.S. national interests were safe.
In the end, opening a political space, rather than diffusing the situation, helped the opponents hold demonstrations, deliver speeches, and attack Savak for its crimes on an unprecedented scale.
Anyway, as they faced the events in 1977 and 1978, they found out that they couldn't do anything because they had done anything possible without being successful. They agreed to have an open political space since the U.S. had asked them. They were to hold a free election and form a national government. But in reality, from early 1979, they lost control and could do nothing, although Jimmy Carter called the Shah several times, allowing him to do anything to control the situation, and assured the Shah of his support. In other words, Carter said what Cyrus Vance had said before: the U.S. didn't want the Shah to fall, but to improve the situation a little bit.
These changes improved the situation for political prisoners, and old lags on small charges were released.
Since Savak had lost its support, it was forced to release many prisoners, those who had finished their terms and those who were in prison for very simple, unarmed activities.
On October the 24th, 1978, 1,126 political prisoners were released. Among them was Safar Qahramani, one who had been in different prisons for about 30 years. By releasing these prisoners, most of them on minor charges like reading forbidden books, the regime wanted to control public indignation. The newly released prisoners went to Behesht-e Zahra Cemetery to pay homage to those who lost their lives fighting for freedom. They said they owed their freedom to public support, not the forced benevolence of the regime. In January 1979, the Shah left Iran under the pretext of receiving medical treatment. Weeks later, Imam Khomeini returned to Iran after 15 years of exile. His arrival gave the nation a new lease of life. Within a short space of time, the people took control of all military and strategic centers, including the Qasr prison, and released all political prisoners. A number of army top brass and Savak agents were arrested and put in the prison for a while. The first trials to investigate their crimes were held in the mosque of this prison. After the 1979 revolution, the Qasr prison was converted into an ordinary prison. But since it was located inside the residential district, in 2001 it was closed down forever. The municipality of Tehran then reconstructed the building and turned it into a museum. A museum that embodies the 200-year history of modern Iran.
During the time I was in the political department of the Garden Museum, I saw the youth we talked to change their opinions completely at the end of their visit. They couldn't believe that in Iran, under the Shah, such things existed. The society must be informed about it. The world must be informed about it.
For me, these things must be etched on the walls of the Qasr prison. Here is the mirror reflecting the downfall of cruelty and corruption.
The Qasr Garden Museum in the heart of Tehran, a place that would once send shivers up and down spines, has now become a favorite haunt for people.
Most of the visitors who come here have a critical attitude. But when they're leaving here, they are overwhelmed and express their kindness to us. When it's explained for them, they realize what had happened here and who had to bear what harms and sufferings.
With its many programs and shows, the museum magnetizes a variety of visitors from friends and families to school students and tourists.
In my opinion, the Qasr Garden Museum is a national place, and its programs must be national and distinguished, and even have a look at international programs. I believe that these bricks in this space are alive with the breaths of people. They must come and go if we want this place to be alive. When you enter Qasr Garden Museum, we see a pleasant place that's due to the breaths of families who come here willingly.
A palace, a prison, and now a museum. A witness to the pain and grief of many people, this edifice has many stories to tell the children of this ancient land.
Well, with the drastic changes the edifice witnessed in the past 200 years, one can only wonder what will become of it 200 years from now. And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week and another Aperture, goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to The Viewpoint. I'm Beta, the host of today's episodes. And today with me, I have two dear guests, experts of today's episode. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Brother, and assalamu alaikum, brother Muhammad.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me once again.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me to have you here with me. So as you know, throughout our history, we had the Islamic Revolution, which was an important event, which had a special role in everybody's life, actually. So, one of the goals of this revolution was independence of identity, which in today's discussion, we're going to go through that topic. I think we can see a lot of these signs of being independent from other countries, and even after a lot of pressure. But the thing is, I think independence costs a lot. You know,
definitely.
The price of independence is so high.
Do you know why it costs a lot?
Also,
very simple example. If you want to be the head of a tribe,
yeah.
So you have to pay too much because you need to entertain those who come to visit you, right? I don't want to meet the head of the region. No, scientifically, yes, this is our goal. We want to be the first and top country in the levels of knowledge and science, right?
Of course.
But if you want to be the big person in your tribe, you have to pay even for those who come to you to visit you, to entertain them and to have to provide them with facilities, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Brother Muhammad, what do you think about this, the matter of the cost of independence?
Let's look at the history, rather, to understand the cost that we have to give. I'm looking at independence in a more abstract, not necessarily the specific to the independence of the Islamic Revolution, though that's, I think, the most idealistic independence that we can find in the world. But consider the independence that we had from the colonial rule of the British and the other European warheads. Look in South America, for example. Caribbean was mainly ruled by the British, but what cost did they have to give for them to be independent from the British? Now, when I mean ruled, meaning that everything from culture, education, economy, to their even lives, because they were considered slaves over there. Look at India, for example, or South Africa. People like Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela had to take a great step, be imprisoned, whipped, even penalized, sometimes by their own people, in some situations, just so that they can find this independence, or rather, I should say, relative independence from the people who are making their decisions. Like I mentioned, the first thing that comes to my mind when I talk about independence in relation when it's opposite of freedom is you making your own decisions. Now, countries who have gone through this are able to make decisions at least relatively better. But still, if you look at the different dimensions of the society, their societies, for example, let's say India, right? Now, where does this education system in India come from? Is it independent? Do they make their own decisions? No.
No, of course not.
Unfortunately. But what about, for example, their economy? Again, more than 50% of the world's economy is dependent on the US dollars. Why? Why is that so? Whenever there is recession, with the global recession, it has to come back to the US dollars. Why does every country have to make transactions based on US dollars? That's economic independence.
Yeah.
So when the US is deteriorating when it comes to their economy, the entire world has to face that same deterioration.
Thank you. So you told me about, I don't know, political and economical independence. But the thing now I'm going to go through is the culture independence. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm really curious about this domain is that is it really too good to have cultural independence? I mean, isn't it dangerous to have cultural independence? Because we have to have cultural interaction with other countries and societies.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any danger in being that much independent in cultural part or not?
No, there is. You see, the thing is, independence, again, does not mean that you don't have relationships with other cultures mm-hmm. or other countries. Rather, it's actually a good thing when you are making your own decision out of your own voluntary move. You make relation with another country, with another culture. There is no problem in that. Even learning from other cultures, the goods and bads, you know, learning the bads from the cultures, trying to improve yours, and learning the good and trying to bring it into your own culture is not a problem. Right. This is how the human fabric, the cultural fabric of life kind of, you know, entangles between each other. You'll find so many things out throughout the history that were kind of loaned and, you know, debted to different cultures. You'd find so many foods coming in from India to Iran and from Iran to India just because of sometimes trade and the relations that we have. There is no problem in that. The problem arises when one wants to enforce one thing in some other culture because he sees it more superior to the others. That's the problem that we have.
But I think the problem is, you know, is not that much visible in a modern world because, you know, for example, we are living here. And if somebody comes and tell you to change into your culture, you won't accept it. You know, they do it so delicately that you cannot understand that you are being defeated by other people's culture.
Yeah, that is,
you know,
that.
What I mean, it's happening unconsciously.
Exactly. The Nixon, the ex-president of the United States, he wrote a book about conquering the world without soldiers. And in the introduction of that book, he mentions why he wrote that book. He said that how they had to pay so much of, you know, cost for the liberations, quote-unquote, that they went through in Vietnam and in Japan and, for example, let's say Iraq and so on, right? And instead of giving blood, their soldiers' blood, it's easier to give cost, you know, and invest in media in trying to kind of enslave the minds of the world into the cultural fabric of the United States.
Yeah.
And that's why you find societies that have a very strong U.S. media presence. You'd find them insecure of their own culture, and they want to be as much, they want to mimic as much as they can to the culture
exactly.
that is being shown in the media. And that is one of the biggest dangerous aspects of it. And you mentioned about how this cultural attack is so unseen. That is how it works out. From media, they don't tell you directly, okay, this is our culture, our culture is more superior, take this now. That's how it works. They move you from step by step, one step at a time. Like, for example, they saw in terms of economic benefit, after the Industrial Revolution, making this movement of feminism, making things equal between man and woman, right, in all aspects of their lives, right, was profitable for the economic lords. Now what they saw is, so the best thing to do is make the entire world be like this.
Yeah, exactly.
The new world order. Just bring the man and the woman in the same level in the society. Let them do the work. The industrial mechanism of the society is moving, but what about the family mechanism? We look at the recent incidents that happened in Qatar. You'd find so many, you know, LGBTQ, whatever it is, it has so many long initials, right?
Yeah.
Their movement, they had a very strong presence there, and they tried their best to, you know, put themselves out. Look at, for example, you know, but then it backlashed against them. People who were in Qatar, they realized, oh, look, this is a different culture. Respect it. Let them be independent. Let them make their own decisions. Why do you have to? That's my question. Why do you have to bring in things that the people socially don't accept, and you have to enforce that in the society? Let them be independent. Let them make their own choices.
Yeah. You know what? The thing is, you know, as you told me, there should be a kind of connection between this independence and freedom, you know? And I think sometimes we confuse these two with each other, especially in the cultural context. So what do you think, Brother Ali, about this issue?
Yeah, actually, I want to say that cultural dependence has some factors, and we have to clarify the factors to see how, I mean, in case we studied it well and we can understand what is the opposite side so that we cope with it. Usually, dominant cultures are apt to actually conquer the other cultures and to actually remove and try to digest them inside themselves. That's why, for example, West is trying to make his own culture, its own culture, dominant culture.
Yeah.
What is our duty? We have to know, we have to understand what are the elements and factors of cultural dependence. One of the factors which is very important is the kind of ontology that we have towards this world. Actually, in case we know the world well and we have understood it well and we learned about it well, then with a tawhidi ontology, we can cope with it very, much more better. Then knowing about the elements of, let's say, Islamic upbringing, the upbringing itself, because it's, again, a sort of, let's say, element which is very influential in conquering the culture of the other culture, conquering the other cultures. So knowing what Islam says in this regard actually can give us and can help us to understand what Islam has in this regard. Another element or factor which is very important is self-confidence. Mm-hmm. To reach this self-confidence that we are able to do whatever we are after. So thinking that, okay, since we have been behind for, let's say, more than centuries, 10 centuries, we cannot go back to this world and we cannot provide the worldly affairs of the people. So we have to actually, like any other country, we have to go and live very submissively with the superpowers. So it's not the case. In case we have a good worldview and then we have understood our religion and our, let's say, whatever we have, our treasures well, then we can cope with the other culture very well. So we can stop in front of them. And we have to understand this point that, again, like every other show that I repeat this point, that Allah's promises are true. We should not see that, okay, we are few in number, but on the other side is very large and huge.
Yeah.
We should not be scared of that, because Allah says, "Kam min fatin qalil ghalabat fatin kathira," and we have seen this promise had happened, I mean, at the time of Battle of Badr, right? Number of Muslims, how many were there in number, and how many were the infidels in the other side?
Exactly.
So in case we say, okay, we are only one country standing in front of this dominant culture and we have to just raise our hands up, so it's not the case. Because we have this rich culture coming from Islam, the enlightening Islam and the culture of the Ahl Bayt, so there is no way for us to get it dependent on any other culture. So I think other cultures should come and sit to learn what Islam says.
Yeah.
So we are sure that we have that rich info that we can even feed any other culture. So we have to be careful and we have to actually vaccinate our younger generation to know only, this is the minimum thing that we can do, to know what they have. In case they know that what they have, I think that would be perfect for them. Unfortunately, due to the pressures that were on us in the last two centuries, this self of being humiliated has been actually imposed in some of us, and we think that we are not able to cope with this
exactly.
culture. What we do, what we can, and inshallah we'll do.
Inshallah, thank you for your elaboration, and thank you, Brother Muhammad, for being here in this episode. Actually, we got to know that actually we have a lot of accomplishment in these different fields of independence, and also we essay to have more independence in different aspects of being independent. Like, I don't know, especially cultural one, which is so important. We have to use, the threat of freedom that they give us to show our own cultural independence in that area of freedom. Mm-hmm. So, inshallah, thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. And this is all the time we had for today's episode. I leave you in the warm embrace of God. And السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Allah, Allah.
سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program for humanity. We are looking at traits that makes me a human being and makes me act like a human being and maintain human rights. In the previous episode, we looked at the verse from chapter Ali Imran in verse 102, where Allah says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اتَّقُوا اللَّهَ حَقَّ تُقَاتِهِ وَلَا تَمُوتَنَّ إِلَّا وَأَنْتُمْ مُسْلِمُونَ. Oh, who you believe, fear Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in a way that he deserves to be. And we were looking at how taqwa and God consciousness and being mindful of Allah, because this is what the word taqwa means, is being mindful and conscious of Allah, how it plays a massive role in trying to prevent wrongdoings and corruptions in society. We discussed that in previous episodes. So if we ask the question, how can taqwa, or being God conscious or mindful of Allah, how does it save lives? How does it work? If a person, a muttaqi, how does it help him save lives? Now, I will mention a few things with you, my dear brothers and sisters, of how we can apply this concept of taqwa, that it might help me and you prevent lives. So number one, when we look at taqwa, it prevents harm. How does it prevent harm? Well, obviously, the answer is by being conscious of Allah and mindful of our actions. This is what taqwa is. It compromises of two parts: being conscious of Allah and being mindful of our actions. So he who is mindful of Allah and conscious of his actions, or vice versa, is less likely to engage in behaviors that could cause harm to themselves and to others. Now, if I'm God conscious and I take my actions seriously, then obviously I will not harm myself first and foremost, nor will I harm others, because I always keep in mind there will come a time where I will be judged. On top of that, I am constantly being watched by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this helps to reduce the risk of violence, the risk of accidents, and other forms of harm. And ultimately, this is the achievement of taqwa. See, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, said, fast the month of Ramadan, and the ayah says, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامِ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ. Siyam, or fasting, was prescribed upon you the same way it was done on the people before you. Why? What is the goal? What is the aim of fasting? لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, that you might achieve mindfulness of Allah. How do one achieve mindfulness of Allah during the month of Ramadan? And obviously, you guys know the answer. Let us just take a short break, and then we'll come back and discuss the answer with you guys. So don't go anywhere.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. So when Allah says to us fast, and he says to us the result of fasting, because every action that we do, every act of worship that we do for Allah, it has a fruit. If I and you do not reap that fruit, then what we're doing is just a waste of time. So if I'm praying, fasting, reading Quran, doing Hajj, doing charity, doing all these acts, but I have never tasted the fruits of these acts, then all these acts are nothing but just exercises that I'm doing. So I'm just getting up and down, reading, just making myself tired. And this is a hadith from Amir al-Mu'min in this regard. This is not me talking here. So therefore we said, Allah says that you might be mindful. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ During the month of Ramadan, one is always what? Constantly aware of his actions, because he does not want to do any act that will invalidate his fasting, correct? I have to be mindful not to eat. I have to be mindful not to drink. I have to be mindful not to swear. I have to be mindful not to lie. I have to be mindful not to do a lot of stuff during the month of Ramadan. This is what taqwa is, mindfulness. So Allah is putting it to us practically. He's saying, I want to make you feel taqwa in a practical way. So for a whole month,